Let's call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria DeAnda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jeff Grover.
Here.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Joan Clendenin.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, moving on, public announcements, item number three. Do we have any announcements? Okay, last chance, seeing none, moving on to public comment. I will read the following. Matters under jurisdiction of the board may be addressed by the general public before or during the regular agenda. However, California law prohibits the board from taking action on any matter which is not on the posted agenda unless it is determined an emergency by the Board of Retirement. Any member of the public wishing to address the board during the, quote, public comment, end quote, period shall be permitted to be heard once up to 3 minutes. Please complete a public comment form and give it to the chair of the board. Any person wishing to make a presentation to the board must submit the presentation in written form with copies furnished to all board members. Presentations are limited to 3 minutes. Do we have any public comment? No. Okay, moving on to item five, consent items. Has everyone had a chance to review the consent items as listed on the agenda?
I make a motion to approve the consent items.
Motion made by Maria DeAnda to approve the consent items. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Jeff Grover. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So moved. Okay, moving on now to item six, committee reports and recommendations for action, standing committees, internal governance committee.
Well, we just met for the meeting, and two items. One had to dealt with the annual audit, and they are our MGO, and I can't even remember what it stands for right now. Thank you. Macias. Thank you. And they're scheduled to review our materials next week. They'll be here to present the final report to the board sometime in November at our one meeting. Everything pretty much is going according to plan. This is a standard audit. So no surprises anticipated. Nothing new being looked at this point. Although Rick did remind us that GASB 68 is coming up soon, 67 and 68, in the next 2 years. So we talked a little bit about that. Other than that, it was just a review of what they'll be doing here next week.
And for the record, GASB 67 and 68 deal with
pension accounting for both systems and the employers within the systems.
Okay, thank you.
Well said, Rick.
Okay, does anybody have any questions for Maria or the committee with respect to item 6A1? All right.
Okay, secondarily, we talked about the salary band for the administrator. The retirement board administrator. As the board knows, we've when we went to give Rick, our administrator, a pay increase this last go around, we met some a roadblock in terms of the pay band that he was in. So what staff have done, and did a very good job at it, is to review the different pay bands for the different positions in the county, as well as some comparative analysis with other counties of a similar size, of the retirement system's size. And you have those notes in your packet. The second page basically has the fourth page. The top part of the report is again counties in our area with similar system balances and what their pay scales are. As was noted by Kathy earlier, is that some of these systems, their administrator is both retirement administrator and CIO, Chief Investment Officer, combined. So it's basically pretty much what Rick is right now. So after reviewing what the different pace bands are for our county, we are recommending that the Internal Governance Committee would like to recommend that the board approve the change to the salary range to salary plan M01 band H. As you can see in yellow, that is band H. Below that is band H plus, and below even that in purple is band I. We discussed what current typical positions are that fall within each of these bands, and we believe that band H is most appropriate at this time.
We did also examine some of the other bands that were not listed out on this report, but those bands had other issues like safety and things like that that made them less comparable.
Any questions?
You know, I didn't think of it when we were in the meeting, but are these the counties we compare ourselves against for salary? I thought Monterey was in that mix.
Monterey is, they're in CalPERS.
Pardon me?
Monterey's in CalPERS.
It's not an exact
37 acts.
She's talking about what?
That's why you use this list rather than the nine county average that the county uses.
Well, there's two answers to that question. If they're left to the staff device, they have eight counties that include Sonoma, Monterey, Sacramento, Santa Barbara, and Ventura. What the board already asked them to do is come back with the eight counties that are in the San Joaquin Valley.
Oh, okay.
And that's the one we would use.
Okay.
So that average is a whole lot different average than those other counties.
Reagan Wilson just picked those. So. And we checked those. Central Valley instead.
But I think a 37 act would be a better
I just didn't think of this before.
I don't have any issue with the committee recommendation, but I think this was the issue that brought up a subsequent request from staff to look at making our maintenance stand there fully independent of county.
Yes, and we are bringing that in September, but I figured we. It seems like we haven't been doing much, and I've kind of been getting subtle hints from you guys about this, so I figured I'd get this thing done and get it off the table, get something done, and then based on the meeting we had with the county yesterday and the week before, we've got a very workable solution here, and we may not need to touch the independence issue, but I'm not prepared to discuss the pros and cons of a move like that right now, and I want some time to prepare for it.
So you've discussed with the county that
absolutely.
If this board decides to change the band, there's no problem, no pushback or anything.
I didn't want to say it, but yes, that's essentially where we are right now.
And this is basically the compromise, is that we look at existing bands for current positions within the county and basically
align them.
Align them. And
the duties of this band, of the H band, seem to be very much in line with Rick's duties and, or you know, the retirement administrator duties. So it seems appropriate and a workable solution.
It's the band that the CEO's office is on and stuff.
But Mike,
Stan
we haven't.
And those guys.
This is not. We haven't forgot about that. We're
going
to do it.
My only point would be that this discussion with the county and the other bands that we should look at, similar to the CEO's office, should have been part of the discussion that we originally.
Absolutely.
It shouldn't have taken a year to get through.
I think that there were several parties that dropped the ball, maybe myself included in that I didn't push it hard enough to begin with, but
I think the record needs to reflect that when we had those discussions with members of the CEO's office, we agreed and our general counsel agreed to do exactly what we're looking at today. fact, our general counsel agreed to do all the necessary research and work with staff on exactly what's before us today. So I think the record needs to reflect that.
And we did talk briefly at our meeting earlier this afternoon about your request, and just to confirm it from this side, is they are working on it. It's not off the table. It needs to be presented along with, as Rick just mentioned, the pros and cons of either, which we touched on, but I'll leave that for later. So I think this is a good compromise. Obviously, it was a learning experience for all of us. There are some things that were missed along the way, for which we're all responsible. But now this is a way to fix it.
So
I think this is the best option right now. Keep us competitive.
So Maria, the committee is basing this ban, this H ban, based upon the fact of Rick's combined duties of both the chief investment officer, his accreditation and credentials, and the fact that he's the retirement administrator.
We basically, the final decision on this was based on comparative duties with existing positions in the managerial classification, as mentioned here, the MO1.
Right.
And at some point in the future, we may need to look at what direction Stan Sara is going, and as we grow in particular, we may want to revise this again. One of the things that we will also be doing as part of the Internal Governance Committee is to revise our bylaws. And along with further research that we're doing on the question Mike just brought up, is it may end up leading to, again, future changes that we'll consider at that time. But this gives us some leeway for at least the next couple of years to make sure that that Rick is compensated as he should be, and still gives us a little time to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
Well, I like the fact that you've created it in such a way that it overlaps within the current ban that we have now. So in other words, we're not automatically moving them into a higher band is at some point down the road when we adopt this. So that I appreciate.
Right. And it was, there were, you know, compromises. So.
Okay.
And we're not reinventing the wheel. We may later.
Right.
But not right now.
Well, yeah, because at some point in the future, we may hire a chief investment officer. So that would change
Correct.
The dynamic a little bit.
Correct.
One final word that the conversations that I had with CEO's office just yesterday and last week were extremely positive. And I think that they solved probably 75% to 80% of the future issues that I thought that we might encounter with them. But we will definitely talk more in depth about this in our admin meeting in September. But it was very positive.
Okay.
So that is the committee's recommendation.
Okay. Does someone want to make a motion?
Recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion to approve by Jim DeMartini, second by Mike Lynch. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Okay, moving on now to item 7, Executive Director. Discussion and action to appoint a Board of Retirement Trustee to the custody bank search request for proposal evaluation team.
Okay. We've been doing a lot of work. SIS is working closely with us, Nate in particular, on a custody bank search. And we haven't, I don't know that we've ever technically done a full-on custody bank RFP. Bank of New York purchased the Western Trust Company clear back in the 80s, and they just became our custody bank. But it's not all a bad thing. They've been the leading bank in this industry all this time. So it's not, we weren't getting shortchanged because we were using Bank of New York. And so we've been able to work well with them for a long time. But the fact that everything's changed, technology has changed, regardless of whether we should change banks or not, it's a really good idea to do our due diligence and do the RFP and do some comparison of these vendors and their services and their fees to see what they have to offer us. Mm-hmm. There's about 4, maybe 5 big players out there, and hopefully they will all respond to the RFP. It's a pretty intense process. Just doing the evaluations could take a few days. We will have a standard matrix worked up that we're going to be comparing them against. But we feel that if we actually have a board member on the evaluation team, it'll help to expedite this process. We'd like, hopefully, not have to do this in a tiered situation. If the evaluation team can narrow it down to one or two finalists, the board may want to interview them. I figure we'll determine that as we get closer. If it turns out that our current vendor is the clear winner and we decide we don't want to change, you may decide you don't need to interview them. You know, that'll be up to the full board's decision whether or not we have to bring them in or not. So I'm looking for a volunteer to work on this evaluation team. And it could, I won't lie to you, it could be a couple days worth of work on somebody's part.
You have your answer already. Donna Riley is raising her
hand. I know, I'm volunteering.
Thank you,
Donna. She doesn't have to be voluntold. So.
I have familiarity with the process and with the product, so I'm happy to do it.
Great, super. Thank you very much, Donna.
No problem.
Council, do we need a board action for the appointment? Okay.
Sure,
good. Yep, there you go.
So stay tuned. There's lots going to happen in the next few months on this.
Okay, moving on to item 7B, discussion and action regarding White Oak Pinnacle Fund Investment Advisory Committee.
On August 7th, we got a correspondence from White Oak asking to appoint an advisory committee to our fund, the Pinnacle Fund. And this is part of the what's in the letter of partnership agreement, and it essentially allows White Oak, the general partner, to either form a group out of members of the limited partners or actually go outside and pick an independent party to act as advisory committee for the Pinnacle Fund. They've chosen the latter, to go out and pick an advisory group. The cost, I believe, was around $38,000, which our pro rata share, at least for the time being, would be about $10,000 a year.
How does that calculate?
So we are approximately 28% of the fund right now. It's not closed, so there'll be more investors coming on as we go along.
Oh, we're 20% of the fund.
Yeah, so I just took that number and multiplied it by the annual fee. We had some, when we first saw the letter and we saw the word offshore, obviously that gave us heart palpitations for a few minutes. So we asked White Oak some questions, and those questions and answers are in your agenda item today. I asked Kathy to do some research on the firm and the principals at the firm. And what did you find?
Most of what I found, of course, was not stateside, so not much showed up in the search engine, the investigative search engine I can use. The principal players are all over the internet and they're in the news. Nothing negative that I could find, but they seem to be real people. A couple of interviews I was able to view that they had done for one of the major news sources. So I don't really have much to tell you on them as other than I could find them, and they do exist. And they are a leading player in this due diligence area in the committee, an advisory committee, and they were a founding group to set up many of the rules and regulations in the Cayman Islands.
And this setup, the way it's structured in the partnership agreement, was laid out. It was addressed in the matrix that Hanson and Bridget did for us, and Scott really didn't have any issues with the way the choice was set up, whether to form a group out of the limited partners or go outside. So what I'm saying is it's not the first time that we've necessarily heard of this concept. It was vetted in the matrix, and Scott didn't have any issues with it. So we can open it up for discussion if you'd like.
How does this compare to, what is it, Grover is serving?
Draven.
Committee, same kind of thing?
No.
No, I think what I'm serving on is just an advisory group of the investors in the fund.
But that was the other choice, an investment advisory or a person.
We don't have fiduciary responsibility. I think these guys would.
Right.
We're hiring them to look over the shoulder in a legal sense of what this fund is doing.
So to specifically answer your question, the other two, their advisory committee is made up by the investors.
Mm-hmm.
White Oak was the only one that could either do it from the investors or go out and hire this independent group.
So will we have a contract with these people?
Or that's a good
part
question.
Of the contract?
No, the general partnership. The partnership has the contract.
White Oak will have the contract.
White Oak will have the contract.
So
I think it would be a bad idea to ask our other two investment funds what they think about or know of anything of DMS.
We can do that. That's a good idea.
They would be within the industry and may even have relationships.
Exactly.
The question I have is, in a sense, as I understood the committee, and the one you're serving on, is to kind of look over the shoulder of the general partner on behalf of this group. It seems odd to have the general partner pick the person that you're having look over shoulder, so to speak.
I don't see it any different. We hire the auditors to come make sure we're doing our job correctly. I kind of look at the relationship we have with MGO is a partnership in that we're paying them, but we want them to catch our mistakes. And so that's a similar situation in this one. They are going to pay them, but they want them to oversee them to make sure the mistakes don't happen or to catch any mistakes. So I see it as a similar situation.
Will they be producing a report on some kind of
We would see it. I don't know, but I don't know that we would see it.
But are they?
I think I read somewhere where they do put out a report. I think it's in this long page right here, if I remember right. But we do have to have, if we're going to sign this, yes, no, or, well, I mean, we can just let it go by and nothing would happen, but if we're going to affirm this action by White Oak, then we would need a vote today because they're asking for an answer by before our next board meeting.
I think Jeff was suggesting a maybe.
conditional. I think
we should act on this in an affirmative fashion, conditional on Rick's discussion with the other two investment funds that are similar, don't turn up something that's an alarm.
Well, I can call them tomorrow or this week, so that'll give us time.
Yeah.
And I guess I can make a decision. If it doesn't sound good, then I just won't return it, if that's okay with you.
That would be fine.
Okay. So would you like to make that motion?
Yeah. I'll move that.
Did you get that?
Yep.
Okay. And Mike O'Neill has seconded that. So do we have any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Opposed.
Okay.
And Darren, I'm going to make a report on Raven. It was 3 months ago now that we had the first advisory meeting. Yesterday morning I got to thinking, I haven't seen any notice, so I sent them an email saying, hey, when's the August meeting going to be? And the guy wrote back and says, I'm not sure we're going to have an August meeting, but we have a deal that's to the point that because it exceeds a certain percentage of the total fund, that we're going to need you advisory folks to weigh in on it anyhow. And so in the next couple of days, I'm going to send you something. As I was walking in here, I got it, so I haven't had a chance to read it, but I want to send the documents that I got to Rick. And hopefully have Fred look at them, make sure that they're within the compliance of what we have in our documents, and then get your professional opinion on it before I respond back.
Super. Thank you, Jeff. Okay, we'll now move on to Executive Director Item C7, Discussion and Action Regarding Active Manager Excess Cash Holding.
Okay.
Otherwise known as the Cash Overlay Program.
So I'm just going to go right to the presentation because the presentation will get into the specifics of this agenda item and what it is we're going to be asking you to do. So the issue at hand is that Stan Serra managers hold a fairly large amount of cash in the aggregate in their portfolios at all times. And the problem is that Stansera has a zero allocation, policy allocation to cash. So we assume that all the money is essentially going to be earning the what the asset classes are expected to earn that they're going to be invested in. Problem is that cash returns are a big drag on the portfolio. Obviously, we all know that they're not earning a whole lot right now. And based on the fact that our discount rate is developed with a 0% allocation to cash, and we are essentially assumed to be fully invested, the cash return on the average balance is dragging down our discount rate by about 7 basis points or 7/100ths of a percentage point. So there's three potential solutions here. Implement a cash overlay program, which we're going to spend most of the time talking about today. We could change the investment policy, which is definitely an option. And we'll explain why it's an option and why the discount rate issue that I had mentioned is changing the investment policy won't necessarily affect the discount rate. It does a little bit, but not much. Or we can require the managers to be fully invested. And that's probably the one that staff wouldn't recommend. And so our recommendation today would be to implement a cash overlay on a notional cash amount of between $3 and $5 million. So the specifics of the issues is that in the aggregate, our monthly manager cash balances since 2006 have averaged $18 million. So on any given day over the last 7 years, if you picked a date, on average, the aggregate account balances that the managers hold would have been about $18 million. The minimum amount at any time over that same period was $8 million, and there was actually a month where there was $82 million in cash sitting in the portfolio. That's a rare event. That only happened one time. And as we mentioned before, that these cash returns kind of drag down the overall portfolio return. The return that we experienced on the average cash balance over the last 3 years has been just south of 0.5%, and the returns on that cash balance over the last 3 years have been about $66,000. Stansera's investment policy essentially says what you see up there. It's the policy of the board to be fully invested to the maximum extent possible. We've already talked about the fact that we don't have an explicit allocation to cash in our investment policy. And also holding cash, this is important. Holding cash is not really efficient since we're already cash flow matching our short duration liabilities. We don't have any liquidity needs right now. We are being fed our liquidity by Dodge and Cox right now. So to hold extra cash, it's not really doing a whole lot for us.
Rick, before you go to the next slide, can we go back to the deployment for that real quick? So are those all saying the same thing?
Yes,
so,
essentially.
So 0.44% is roughly $66,000, and 0.15% is roughly $66,000.
I annualize that for you.
Those are different terms for all three of the same thing.
Yes.
So one of them isn't against the whole 1.4.
No.
Okay.
I just annualize the 44 just to approximately get what the annual rate is.
Thanks.
So we're earning 15 basis points on our annual cash balance, essentially. So why do Stansera managers are holding so much cash? I asked several of them. I talked to SIS, so I did a little bit of homework on this question here. The first three items up there are very small reasons. They sell securities, so they hold cash for certain periods of time as they're waiting to redeploy that money. They get dividends and coupons off the equities and the bonds. Also, Stansera has some constraints. Good example would be fixed income. Let's say that what's a good example? Let's say Dodge and Cox. So we have a restriction on Dodge and Cox's bond portfolio that they have to have they have to be of investment grade quality on a weighted average basis. So let's assume that Dodge and Cox is looking at this next investment that they want to invest in, and they by investing in that in their next best investment, it would tip the scales and put the weighted average of the grade of the portfolio below investment grade. So Dodge and Cox can't make that investment because they would be violating something in our investment policy. Well, it wouldn't be wise for them to pick the next best investment or the third best investment. So they have constraints, and they don't want to be investing in something just to be investing in if they don't believe that that's the best investment to invest in. So Stan-Sara constraints also put some pressure on them to not be fully invested. The big thing, though, is tactical. They want to keep this cash on hand when they see tactical opportunities in the market that present themselves. They all said the same thing. This is the big reason why they like to keep the cash on hand. And it's what we pay them for. We pay them for their expertise in deciding when those opportunities exist and when they take advantage of those. But that's the biggest reason why the cash balances are so large.
Rick, I have a question.
Sure.
Wouldn't they be able to take tactical advantage by selling something they're not hot on and buying into the
They tax? Would, but what if they're hot on every security in their portfolio? Like Delaware Investments only has 30 investments, so they don't have a lot of investments anyway. So they may be their top 30, and they don't think it's wise to get out of that any of those securities.
What about the cost of the transactions to get cash? What's the trade-off?
Do you mean
if we're holding a small amount of, our managers are holding a small amount of cash,
yes,
and if we invest all of it and we need cash, then there's transactions.
Absolutely.
So how does that compare?
I mean, there's obviously a transactional cost by forcing them to be invested. But again, I don't foresee any need in at least the short to intermediate term to have to ask any of our managers for cash. We've got Dodge and Cox doing that for us right now.
On a regular basis.
Yes, we've got them efficiently managing our short-term liability needs, so we have no need for cash right now. Now, that's not to say that something drastic is going to happen. I don't foresee that happening. But even if the markets were to take a dive, that doesn't mean that the fixed income that Dodge & Cox is managing is not going to be throwing off that cash. The market value of the bonds that the cash is coming from may go down, but the cash flows themselves won't go down, as long as there's no default on the bonds. So there's really no need for us to ask them for any money.
Say that again.
We don't
There's really no need for us to what?
To ask our active managers for any money because we have our cash flow needs covered.
That's a hard concept for people to accept.
Which was a hypothetical.
What's that?
You've already dealt with it, so it was a hypothetical that we would all of a sudden need more.
Exactly. There were times at CalPERS where they ran into situations where they had to, but they were in some very exotic investments. And there were large capital calls at very inopportune times, and they didn't have the cash to cover it. We're not in those types of investments.
The only thing is we have potential calls.
We do. We've got
for
them.
For the
yes.
people we joined.
Absolutely.
What's the magnitude of that?
We are invested about 45, probably close to half of the amount right now. But we definitely are set up in our portfolio from our managers. Everybody understands that there may be needs for that in the future.
You have liquidity.
Absolutely. We've had conversations with all of them.
Rick, just clarify for me one more thing. How do our money managers get cash? And I know that sounds like a dumb question. But basically, if they're supposed to be fully invested, I'm assuming that they'll sell off some investments and hold on to this amount of money, like you said, for opportunities. But other than that, I mean, is that as simple as it gets?
I think that's the biggest. I think that accounts for 90% of the cash balances we see in there. I don't fully understand. I mean, I understand why they would want this money for tactical purposes, but I guess what I don't understand is why the magnitude of the amount that's there. If there's, you saw this slide right here. If on average there's $18 million over the last 7.5 years in these account balances, that I don't understand why it's so high. I could see 5%.
Could it be a form of a hedge? It would dampen a market drop.
Maybe they feel by investing this, there's just not enough investments out there, and it would drag down their returns and make them not look good.
Do they have the opportunity to do what you're saying of invest it, or have we restricted our managers such that they're supposed to buy stocks so they can't invest
correct.
It like we're doing it?
That's correct. We mean like what we're proposing
talking about
today?
So they can't do what we're proposing.
You're exactly right.
Okay, so they could be, if they think the market might go down, they might want to hold cash and they might think it's MISE to invest it, but they're restricted by our rules.
Right. They could actually, if we gave them permission to do what we're going to suggest today, they could actually take that cash and equitize it for very short periods of time and earn equity returns, like even on a daily basis. They could enter into daily contracts and earn daily equity returns, and then at the point in time when they think that's maybe not such a good idea, or we want to go ahead and pull the trigger and invest in this company, then they could end the contract immediately and either keep it purely in cash or go out and buy the investment.
So,
but our investment policy doesn't allow them to do
so
that.
So one option would be to change the policy to allow them to do it.
Yeah. But you know what? The only issue with that is there's a lot of governance issues there on our part, and I don't feel comfortable having to watch eight managers to see what they're doing in the futures markets. I really, really don't.
We can widen the band.
Yeah, this is a very simple concept, the way we're proposing here. It's very simple and it's easy to govern from our perspective. So this is the average cash balances annually each year. You can see here that this is a systemic issue. This is not transitory. It's never gone below, on average, it's never dropped below $13 million. So this is not something that just is a fluke. And the black here in this chart is the actual interest earnings on the actual account balances. It's just the interest earnings superimposed on the slide prior. Those numbers are in millions. So you can see that like the first 6 months of 2013, we made about $10,000 on our average cash balance. And the most we made when cash rates were reasonably high was about $1 million in 2006. So the question then is, what would have happened had this cash been fully invested over that same period in, for instance, an S&P fund or a combination of index funds with roughly the same mix that Stansera has? So here's the returns that would have gotten that we, well, the yellow one is what we actually did get, the returns we got over this period. And the green is the S&P 500, and the red is the Stansera return. One thing that's very interesting when I put this slide together, and I didn't really think about it until I looked at this, you can see how equity-centric our portfolio is. Look how closely it follows the S&P 500. We have a lot of equity exposure and risk in our portfolio, almost identical to the S&P, just a little less. I think that's what the fixed income and the diversification does.
So what are you saying, we should go into an index fund?
No.
Kind of making you wonder, though, about how it compares to a managed fund.
Yeah, definitely. But it's interesting.
Save some money there.
And so here's the column in the middle is the actual returns that we experience, that Stansera earns. So over this last 7.5 years, we've netted $2.5 million on our cash balances. And the column on the left and the column on the right are hypothetical returns had we been in a cash overlay position. Now you can see, one thing you need to realize here is that if you look in 2008, the strategy that we're going to be suggesting was a losing proposition because cash returned much better than the markets did. And you can see that for 2011, kind of the same thing, except we underperformed the S&P mostly due to the special situations fund. But you can see over the long run that this should be a positive proposition because in the long run, it should always be the case that equities and bonds would outperform the short-term cash market. If not, nobody would invest in anything but short-term cash. So in the long run, this has to be a winning proposition, but in the short run, you're going to get volatility and losses from time to time.
Is it significant that we are now in a cash balance the same, basically the same as we were just before 2008, just before everything caved in?
Right here?
Yeah.
Well, I think what you should take away from this is the trends. It looks like that we trended down when the markets were... So it looks like the managers were going out and actively using that cash. Maybe they thought they saw some good buys out there as the markets were trending down. And now we're trending back up. Maybe they don't see such attractive alternatives out there. We could debate.
I'm not sure I agree with Joan, though, because we're not anywhere near where we were in 2008.
On a cash balance?
I was looking
at, we're down at 2007. Less than 15 million, it's almost 25 million over there.
But what we are saying, if I understand correctly, is if our managers do predict a problem, cash is a place they can go to.
To take advantage. And
so if they were trying to hedge themselves, they could put us in a higher cash position.
Right. It looks like in this case, though, I think that they were getting rid of the cash. They were buying what they thought were probably attractive stocks and bonds when the markets were going down. A lot of people were doing that.
Yeah. Well, they're not perfect.
So here's, we'll talk about the cash overlay now that we understand the problem. So what it is you're essentially what's called equitizing idle cash. So you equitize cash. Instead of earning cash money or cash returns, you're earning equity returns. This allows our managers to keep their cash balances intact for their tactical reasons and allows us to earn returns based on our investment policy, based on our asset classes and target amounts that are in our investment policy. One of the things you're going to hear as we go through the rest of this presentation is the word notional, and that's simply the amount of cash that you are equitizing. So if you want to take $3 million of the manager's cash balances and earn equity returns, you say you want to notionalize $3 million. It's a notional amount. Everybody uses that word, so if we do this, you're going to probably hear that word a lot. There's nothing mysterious about that word, though. So a cash overlay is, like we said, it's a way to gain exposure to the returns of an asset class using cash you have on hand. And this example here, what it is at its basic core is essentially one investor trades the returns they would get on a $3 million notional position for the return on an equity position. That's exactly what's going on. You just trade the returns on cash for the returns on stock.
For me, Rick?
Yeah.
Wouldn't this be very similar to a swap?
It is. It's a swap, but it's just a different way of doing it. Swaps and futures mathematically can be broken down into the exact same type of transaction.
Right.
So there's somebody on the other side of whatever we're doing.
Yes.
Who's betting against us.
I wouldn't say betting against us.
They may have cash needs. Where
we'll get into that.
Let's do it. Let's say it differently, though. I can understand somebody in our position wanting to do this. I can't understand why someone in the other side would want to do it, so I need to know in layman's terms why they would want to.
Definitely. So that's a very, very good question, because every time that we talk about this issue, somebody always asks that question.
I mean, you can understand it in mortgage swaps, because they have rotten apples that they're trying to trade for real money.
But, right.
So we want to know that we're not doing that here.
So theoretically, I'm going to give you the theoretical reason first, and then I'll give you the practical reasons. But theoretically, markets are efficient, and so risk and reward are properly priced. So in other words, when you buy an equity as opposed to holding cash, it doesn't mean you're going to be guaranteed to get the equity return over the next 3 years. Along with that equity that you're holding and the expected return that's associated with that equity is a lot of risk. And so what makes this a risk-neutral proposition is the cash return, the small cash return, is accompanied by a commensurate amount of reduction in the risk. So it is a risk-neutral proposition. That's the theoretical reasoning behind it. And you have to realize there are obviously people out there who are sitting on a lot of cash, and they are earning cash returns, and they have the ability right now to take that cash and buy a stock with it if they want it, but they're choosing not to. So their decision is based on the amount of risk that they want to assume. They don't feel that the risk that the equity market is throwing off is worth getting into that type of position.
So they're willing to settle for less of an equity return than they would get in the marketplace for a guaranteed return.
Exactly.
It's commensurate. Even though it's a 2.5%.
Exactly. It's commensurate with the risk. And that's the way markets today are pricing cash returns. That's the way they're pricing equity returns.
So who's carrying the actual difference in risk?
So when you swap, right?
If they could have had 14%, and they're giving up that 14% for 2.5 guaranteed, and we would have had none, and we're getting 2.5.
You guys are this whole proposition is exactly that. It trades the risk. That's what this is. An insurance policy is what it is. It's going out and selling your risk or buying risk because of what you need to do, or what you think you want to do, or what your convictions are on market expectations. That's exactly, it's a trade of risk.
And the duration is, for each trade, is how long?
You can go, you can buy a day contract, or you can buy a, I think you can buy a year contract. I only talked with our consultant on a 3-month contract. But if I remember right, when I was studying this, I think you could actually go out and buy year-long contracts. So one of the practical, or several of the practical reasons, you have short-term market dislocations, and that's essentially if you think, let's say, for instance, you think that next week Ben Bernanke is going to say we're stopping all easing, and what you think is there's going to be, the markets are going to take a dump for, let's say, a week or two, and then they're going to go back up when the market digests the information. So you would short, you would sell your equity exposure for 3 weeks, and then that allows you to earn safe cash returns for 3 weeks, but not have to sell your equities. So you're holding your equities, and you get back your equity exposure when the 3-month or the 3-week period is over. So there's dislocations that are reasons why people might do this. One of the things rebalancing here. This is probably the most efficient reason why we, pension plans, institutional plans, would actually do something like this. And I think that if you folks decide this is something you want to do today and we get comfortable with this, later on down the road we can use this as a tool to rebalance our portfolio without having to actually sell assets or buy assets to keep us in balance. It's a very efficient way of keeping your portfolio in balance.
So the only downside is if that chunk of risk that we bought for that duration takes that dump you just talked about, while we hold it, then we just bought the loss.
Exactly. And I'll show you, I got a nice spreadsheet that we're going to see day to day what the gains and losses are and what it would have meant to us based on real movements in the S&P index for the last 2 years. We'll see exactly what the risks are. I won't get into timing. Trust me, there's a lot of other practical reasons why people would want to enter into this type of transaction. So here's the fundamentals. This is the first time we've mentioned the word futures. So what we would do is we would enter into a futures contract, and in most cases it's with the exchange themselves. They are the counterparty, and generally what they do is they'll just take the other end of the trade because there are others out there that may come along later on and want, you know, the opposite end of our trade. So they bring the buyers and sellers together. But since they are the market makers, this is the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, since they are the market makers in these types of contracts, they are obligated to take the other side of these trades. That way there's a liquid market, and that's why these contracts are also very easy to get into and to get out of, because there's always a willing participant to take the other side, and that's the exchange. Since the exchange is the counterparty, there's really no risk of default unless the Chicago Mercantile would go under. There's essentially no risk. They also augment that risk by asking that both parties put up a margin, or a reserve account, I would call it. The industry calls it a margin account. So they, before you enter into this contract, you have to post a certain margin, and those margins must be maintained at a certain level throughout the contract. And the positions are marked to market daily. So each day the exchange looks at the S&P return, and they look at the cash return, and they take the difference, multiply it by the notional amount, and they exchange money from both parties' account every day based on who is a winner and who is a loser. And this is, in this example we're going to talk about, you trade cash returns for S&P returns. So the daily settlement formula here is, I think I just mentioned this, it's the S&P return minus the cash return times the notional amount. And if the S&P return is greater than the cash return, then the holder of the S&P side would get a gain. And if the S&P return is less than the cash return, then the holder of the cash return would get the gain. And if you've ever heard of the word zero-sum game, this is a perfect example of what a zero-sum game is. If somebody wins a penny, somebody loses a penny. It's a perfect exchange back and forth between the accounts every day.
It can't be a win-win.
No.
It's always a win-lose.
No. You're exchanging risk perfectly here. I think, Jeff, that's the exact best way to look at this. This is a risk transfer. That's all it is. So if we look at it graphically, how this thing would play itself out, you can see that the first thing you do is you enter into this 3-month contract for a $3 million notional with the exchange. These numbers, what you see, margin accounts aren't exact, so I'm just using these. So each side posts $400,000 into these accounts. So what you see right off the bat here is you're actually earning returns on a $3 million notional amount for a $400,000 investment into these margin accounts. This is the definition of leverage. That's exactly what leverage is. But we're not leveraging as a speculative bet here. We're leveraging to hedge our, or use it to equitize the cash that should be earning these returns but aren't. So this is not a speculative game that we're playing here. So at the bottom thing, in day one, let's assume that there was a 0.5% gain in the S&P 500. So if you multiply 0.5% by the $3 million, you'll see it's $15,000. And so then what happens is 15 grand is taken out of the exchange's account and stuck into the investor's account. So we got the same thing on the top, and let's say we get down to day 17. This is where you can see the downside or the risks involved in a futures contract. So let's say that there was a negative 25 basis point return on the S&P. So that forced the investor to throw off $7,500 back into the exchange's bucket there. If we assume that the maintenance margin of the reserve account is $160,000, that means that the exchange would then call you up the next day and say you need to pony up at least $7,500 to keep that maintenance margin at $160,000. And so this is a demonstration of a margin call if that were to happen. You can also see, I just threw this in at the end there, you can see that the exchange took $30,000. You are allowed to remove money from your margin account under certain conditions. If it gets to a certain level, you are allowed to move it out. I wouldn't necessarily suggest we would ever do anything like that, because by leaving it intact, it's just more cushion against future margin calls. So then at the end of the contract, the return on the notional cash position will be very, very close to the return you would have gotten had you invested in the S&P 500. And now I want to show you, before we move on, I want to show you a specific example of what would have actually transpired. So this is the bad year. I wanted to make sure I got a good year and a bad year in here. This is 2011, 2012. And if you look up in the upper right in the box section there, that kind of summarizes exactly what happened over this period of time. This assumes that we equitized $3 million of the manager's cash for a whole year. And so what we had to do is we have to place, with the exchange and the custodian, we had to place $450,000 in the initial margin account at the beginning. And then throughout the year, you can see on a daily basis, if you look at this right here, this column, you can see the actual margin calls. This column here has the actual gains and losses. And so you can see what our margin account is as we go along. Oh, wait, hold on. That's not right. Margin account is over to the right, I think. Oh, I don't have... It's the sum of the two. Sorry. Okay, so I didn't put a total for the margin account. See, the exchange requires you to put a certain amount. And then if we have somebody else manage this for us, like the custodian, they would ask for an additional amount as well. So I broke it out to make it as realistic as I could. So our margin account would be the sum of these two right here. But you can see here the gains and losses on the position each day as you go along. And then you can, if you scroll down, you can see on August 8th, there was a margin call of $167,000. Now, fortunately, the day after, there was a gain of $120,000. So that gave us back a cushion again, a fairly decent cushion. So you can see the fluctuation in the margin account as we go along. And then we don't get another margin call until October 3rd, and it's $46,000. Again, fortunately, the next day we got a $55,000 gain. Yeah. And I think that was the last margin call of the whole year, if I remember right, if I'm looking at this thing.
So looking back up at the box, is this assuming a 1 year investment?
This is a one-year
contract.
Right. It would be one. It would be 4 3-month rolling contracts, essentially.
Okay. So if I'm reading this, bottom line is we got a 0.12% return.
Yes. No. Okay. So let's go through. So the total we had to kick down for this position was $663,000. The margin bucket at the end of the contract had $648,000. Mm-hmm. That equates to a negative 1.86% return on the actual cash that we invested. But on the notional amount, which is what we're trying to do here, the notional amount, the actual S&P earned negative 43 basis points, and our notional earned negative 61 basis points. So you can see it's very close to what you would have earned had we actually invested that $3 million in the S&P 500. This was what we actually earned on our cash position, this 12 basis points for that year.
Bless you.
That's the bad year. This is what would have happened if we did this in the fiscal year that just ended a month and a half ago. Same thing, we invested $450,000 in our initial margin, but there were no margin calls last year. And so the margin account at the end of the year was $1.2 million, which equates to 175% return on the money that we actually invested, the $450,000. What we really earned on a notional basis, the S&P earned 25.5% and we earned 25.33%. So you can see that this is a very efficient transaction and you get essentially the returns that you're looking to get based on the index that you apply this contract to.
Okay.
And so there were no margin calls during this entire amount. And you can see, well, the reason there's no margin calls is because the margin account at the beginning is so large. When you have a custodian or somebody else do this, they ask for extra money. So it really limits the probability of margin calls as opposed if you went directly out to the futures market themselves, because the exchange would probably only ask for about $180,000 in margin up front. But the custodians ask for a lot more, so they feel that they don't want to have to come back and continually ask the client for money and so forth.
So for over 2 years we netted, if you look at the 2 years combined, we netted like 23%.
Yeah. Yes.
Rick, what's the minimum and maximum you have to play with here?
I've already talked to our custodian, and if we started small, like I'm going to suggest later on, that's fine. He didn't say a minimum and maximum, but I'm assuming since he said our $3 million or $5 million was fine, that we shouldn't have an issue there. There is some issues that, and you know, another thing, we're not, if you guys agreed to this today, it's not like we are going to go out and do this tomorrow. One of the biggest reasons I wanted to bring this today is we want to include this in the custodial RFP. We want to give them a price. What are they going to charge us to do this right here? So I wanted to get your blessing or nay on this today, so it would give us time to put this in the RFP.
When you say margin placed with custodian and total invested overlay position, those two numbers up there are the same?
Yeah, they are, because it's the sum of the it's what you place with the custodian at the beginning and plus any margin calls you get during that year.
Rick, what about some of the other options like repurchase agreements or sweep accounts, things like that might be available?
They're definitely out there. Swaps are another very efficient transaction. I'll be perfectly frank with you. I thought of all these things, and I thought that this was the easiest for us to get our arms around at first. This is a very simple transaction, and it's efficient. It's just pretty much as efficient as swaps are, but I think it's easier to understand and to explain and to feel comfortable with than a swap. We can totally look at swaps if you want to do that.
Well, no, I mean, like, repurchase agreements, you know, that market is huge, and it's easy to move in and out of that, and they can be for longer periods of time, and you can just state what sorts of collateral you want or are willing to accept.
You can. Generally, I thought, and maybe you know a little bit more about this than I do, but usually repos are reasonably short-term, right?
They can be long.
Okay.
You can get a one-year repo.
Okay. Well, we can definitely look into that as an option.
But it's the repo market is so large. I mean, it seems like that would be fairly easily accomplished. That and then, you know, just a basic sweep account, you know, that would put it into cash products.
We use a short-term sweep every night.
So
that is used as well.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure.
We can do this in addition to that.
I'm not sure I'm understanding how the sweep account would work here.
Well, they'd have to transfer cash back to the custodian, and then the custodian would sweep it, you know, take whatever balance was there at the end of the day and sweep it into, again, any type of investment that we had specified.
I see. Okay, I see what you're saying. However, though, I would think that efficiently they would have to do something like this. They would take it and pretty much do something like what we were gonna do.
Some
would,
kind of swap.
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah.
I don't think they would go out and buy the stock.
No,
thinking
no.
They'd have to sell
but
it.
They would put it more, sweep accounts are generally cash instruments. So they're not, you know, stocks. They carry a lot less return, but they carry a lot less risk as well.
Okay. But you're talking about asking as part of your RFP process for this?
Yes. What
so you could ask if they have those other types to look at also?
Yes, absolutely.
Would the custodian only do charge a transaction fee if there's a margin call, or at what point?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
We met with Bank of New York Mellon on this issue a couple weeks ago, and I wasn't very pleased necessarily with their program. And my gut tells me that I think we should ask the custodians what they would charge us to do this. But I think that in the long run, if this is a staple that we want to include in Stan Sarah's portfolio, that we look to a professional that does this and only this. I've talked to several CEOs from 37 Act Systems on this issue, and they all use, a couple of them do use their custodian, but most of them use another consultant to do this.
So you could ask the custodian what he charged, and then you go to the other party
exactly.
And do a better deal.
That's what we're looking to do.
Uh-huh.
So we only have a couple more slides left. So here's the specifics, and this down at the bottom, if you look, this was an example we got from Bank of New York Mellon. Their fees were 5 basis points of the notional amount and a minimum of $35,000 annually. But I don't know how that compares yet because we haven't talked to anybody else, but
right.
I just wanted to give you an idea of something. And so what we're doing is we're recommending that we start small. We know that the manager's average cash balance is about $18 million. We would like to start with about $3 to $5 million. And again, we're not going to go out and do this right away. We just want to know that if you're interested, essentially, in this concept. That would require about a $400,000 to $700,000 margin based on whether it's $3 to $5 million. And we can pretty much tap the manager's cash to fund the margin account because if it never drops below $8 million, they're not going to miss in the aggregate $400,000. I mean, it just never gets that low. So I have no problem taking this cash from their accounts. I mean, if they're going to leave it at $8 million at the most and 18 on average, they deserve us to skim a little bit off those accounts.
And you're saying that as for right now, because if this looks, we continue to do this and want to expand it in the future, then there theoretically there would be no cash on the for any of the managers in the future.
Well, if we ever got to a point, the only reason I'm suggesting we could take it from the manager's accounts now is because we're asking for a very small amount.
Right.
If we ever got it to a larger amount, then I think we'd have to come up with the money somewhere else so they can continue to have this cash for their tactical reasons.
So there's always going to be this little bit of, we're never going to get completely 100% out of actual cash.
No. No, no, no. That's not the goal. The goal here is not to take all the cash.
Well,
you know what?
0% is 0%.
I don't want to confuse anybody here. I'm not taking it because we don't want them to have access to it. I just think it's a very liquid source of money to fund the margin account that they don't even come close to needing.
Rick, I don't understand. If the act managers have too much cash, why don't we just tell them or to invest in
good question.
In habits? I don't know why we're going to use the whole scheme with new act managers.
That's one of the alternatives, and we'll get to that. We're almost there right now, so we'll talk about that. And then also, if we did this, we would not tap the margin account if it got overfunded. We would like that extra insurance in there. Let that margin account build, so if there are down periods, that we wouldn't have to get these margin calls. So the risks here, the risks are the margin calls. The size and timing are really unknown. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know when we're going to get them. The timing of the returns are very important here, too. If you get a series of good returns early on in the contract, your margin account is going to build up, and you've got a lot of insurance and cushion against future margin calls. If you hit a situation where you start the contract and you have some bad returns early, then you're going to be bumping up against that margin requirement, you know, throughout the life of the contract. Fortunately, if we go through a custodian or another manager, they ask for more margin, so it really reduces the overall risk of margin calls. Worst case scenario, largest loss here in this case, or the largest margin call, would be the entire notional amount. But that could only happen if the S&P went to zero. So that's your biggest risk here.
What is the risk of a Lehman Brothers?
If Lehman Brothers, something like that happens?
No. What would happen if we were holding Lehman Brothers when they went out?
100 years.
But yeah, what if, I mean, what happens to us if we're holding, if our exchange is Lehman Brothers and they go under?
Yeah.
We're not doing that. We're buying the S&P, right?
We're buying the
whole batch.
Okay.
So
the index.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. If Lehman Brothers is part of the index, then our return for that day, week, month
it's
is going to be
down.
It's just
the index. It's not, okay.
Right. Yes.
I'm looking at this as an individual swap.
Actual securities?
Of securities. No. Okay. So
remember,
now I'm better.
Yeah. He's saying that the other party...
Which is why the whole index had to go clear to zero to have a wash.
Okay. But he's saying the other party is not a potential Lehman Brothers because it's the index itself.
It's the exchange.
It's exchange itself. That's a hard concept, too.
But what if the market as a whole took a real...
Well, could the exchange go under?
Yeah, I guess
that
it could, yes.
That would be really unlikely.
Zero that day, everything you have in your market...
Yeah, it's not...
Right, but zero was the most.
But you're under the table hiding at that point, so does it really
matter?
Yeah,
there are things
matter.
In the air that you're not worrying about.
If the worst case scenario happened, we wouldn't be worried about our overlay.
No.
We'd be worried a heck of a lot more.
Well, the other thing is if the cash overlay is frozen... And you couldn't touch it, which is what happens in Lehman-type situation. You don't have a cash need.
I don't understand. What
you are covering your cash needs.
Yes. Oh, right.
Dodge
right,
and cost.
Right.
You're not desperate for cash.
Exactly.
Well, like after 9/11, they froze the markets for a week. But you didn't need to cover anything. You didn't know it was frozen.
Right.
Everything was closed.
Yeah. Both sides.
Yeah.
So
we weren't paying checks, we weren't.
A little history. Evidently, this strategy was presented in 06, and nothing was done at that time, so just to let you know that they did.
I don't even remember 9 years ago.
I can't remember.
Well, it would maybe be better if it was 7 years ago.
7 years, sorry. Yeah. Sorry.
So a few more slides.
I'm going to do that next year.
This is not a permanent strategy. These contracts are very short term. They're easy to enter into. They're easy to exit out of. And again, like kind of hinted at earlier, if we get comfortable with this concept, there's a lot better uses for this type of strategy than just equitizing cash. It's a very, very efficient way to get your exposure to the classes that you want very cheaply. San Diego's doing, there's a lot of systems that are actually doing it. Here's the other systems overlay amounts. You can see there's a few that have none. And okay, so really fast, we'll talk about the second alternative. Revise the policy to include an explicit allocation of 1% to cash. This is a very valid solution to this problem. And here's the reason why. Our discount rate has a 10 basis point margin of conservatism in it. In other words, even though our discount rate is 7.75, the asset allocation and the returns on the asset classes say that our asset allocation is expected to earn 7.85%. So we have a 10 basis point margin of conservatism. So if we decided to allocate 1% of the portfolio to cash, we would drag the discount rate down by about 0.75 of a percentage point, but it would still be above the 7.75% return. It would just reduce the margin for conservatism in our discount rate. So it is an option, and it's not a bad option. There's only one system that I found that actually has an explicit allocation to cash, and that's Contra Costa. They have 0.9% dedicated to cash in their portfolio.
But if we do alternative number one, doesn't alternative number two automatically happen?
Well, it's happening right now whether we want it or not. If we do alternative one, it's going to bring up that 7 basis points, maybe only make it 6 or 5 because we're only doing $3 million or $5 million. Right now, this is what's going on right now. Our discount rate, our expected return, our expected discount rate is being dragged down by 7 basis points because we're investing $50 million in cash.
How much is that? How much is that?
What's that? 7 basis points?
Is it 1.54 times 7 basis points?
Oh, God. I'm sorry.
Are you over 50 now, right?
Yeah, it's $1 million.
It's like, hey.
A little over $1 million. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Someone's going to take them off. But so it's a million dollars worth. It's dragging us by $1 million right now.
So, I mean, again, this is a viable option, and we still maintain our discount rate. We just lower the margin of conservatism, but we are doing that right now by not investing that. We just need to change the investment policy, I believe, to explicitly say that's what we want to do. And then alternative three is what Mike alluded to. In my opinion, this is probably not recommended, since we pay them for their ability to be tactical and their ability to make us money. Also, the investment policy says that we've pretty much given that decision over to the investment managers, so we can change that as well. One of the things, though, that I would suggest is that by simply assuming that if we force them to be fully invested, that they're going to earn the returns that they're giving us right now, that's not necessarily the case, because we don't know the investments that they're not investing in by holding this in cash. If we force them to invest, they may be investing in something that they may not necessarily want to invest in. And so it's not fair to say that we would have earned exactly the same return that we earned from them over the last year or two had we forced them to be fully invested. Because it's not the case that they would have necessarily invested perfectly pro rata in what they're investing in now. They may decide, okay, I'll go down to this stock here. It's the next best on my list, even though I really don't want to do it. But I'm going to go down to this stock here. And so we don't know how that would affect the return.
Would that be only the equities? Because this private equity funding really wouldn't work on that.
Right.
Now we're only 45% invested of $100 billion.
Right. This has nothing to do with that.
It's only the
other active managers. Exactly. So that's another alternative, but I think it's the least desirable out of the alternatives.
Rick, I'm just totally confused. I am over 50. No, I just turned
50. Way over.
If we have an average of 8 million for DAX managers, have 8 million.
Let the record reflect that.
We don't want to interfere with their judgment and dictate that they have to invest more. Then we're going to take some of that holdover anyway and give it to another manager to do this cash overlay thing and pay the fees for that.
Correct.
And somehow all this saves us money.
Well, it should make us money in the long run. It should make us, and especially if you look at the last few years, it should make us a fair amount of money based on the yields that we're getting on our cash. I mean, we're getting 15 basis points annually on that cash that's sitting there. So,
to Mike's point, though, we don't actually go and get our cash sitting in somebody's account and trade it, right? We just have an accounting, and they're swapping access to the accounts.
What
money's not trading hands.
My suggestion is to take the money to fund this, is to take it from the managers, take it off their accounts. But it's
so
such a
yes,
but it's such a small amount. In fact, 450 over 18.
Well, you're just taking the margin.
We're taking 2% of their cash.
Oh, you're just taking.
We're
the
just
margin.
Taking the margin.
The
we're
margin.
Not, right,
account.
Right. We're not
you're
taking
not
the
taking
notional.
The 3 to 5 million.
Still swap what they have in their account. You're just not taking the money out of it.
No, we can get the returns on the money they have in their account by taking only 2.5% of their money. That's the beauty of this.
So we're not putting them in a position of options.
No. So they can still have 97.5% of all their money to do whatever they want with.
But you do bring up an
That's
interesting
pretty
point.
If we have
our managers in a position where for some reason they think there's going to be a couple of months down market, they may choose to take 25% and put in cash because it's their best option. They have to be invested. So we also have, in our structure of investment policy, the possibility of creating a very large cash position.
Yes.
Which would significantly dampen our return. Yes.
And we saw that 1 month. There was $82 million in cash 1 month sitting on
right.
the books.
And yet that was their best option, in their opinion.
For a short period of time.
For a short period of time.
So I agree, that's a good point, too. By forcing them, then they can't take advantage of holding that cash until they feel
it's
time to deploy it.
If we voted yes today, how soon would you implement something?
I think it's going to be probably at least end of the year, beginning of next year.
Okay. So what if we took a couple of months to think about
it? Oh, sure. Well, okay.
Well, what I heard you say is you want to include this in the RFP.
We can still put it in.
When's the RFP?
We got to send that out.
We can still put that in the RFP.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct.
Yeah.
But that's what he was saying. That's
okay. Whether we voted on it.
The only thing is we need to decide this sooner than later because of the investment policy. We're revising our bylaws, and we're doing our investment policy overhaul. And I really, truly believe this needs to be put in here because, the biggest reason is when we go do the actuarial evaluation next year and we develop the discount rate or the year after, the actuary needs to know what your allocation to cash is because he's going to use that in forming his discount rate opinion. So if we allocate 1%, that's going to lower the discount rate.
Why do we have to have a percentage in the policy?
Because of what I just said. It's because of what I just said. When the actuary develops the discount rate, we have to explicitly tell him how much money we are putting in cash that's going to earn X percent so he can develop his best estimate discount rate. Right now, Graham went back and developed the discount rate based on the assumption that none of our money's in cash.
Yeah.
It's all in the asset allocation that's out there. So
if we implemented this, and the discount rate now is 7.75, would it be realistic to think that it would reduce by 7? So it would then, for no more risk, no more management, it would be 7.67 or 7.68.
By not doing anything right now, it's dragging down the expected discount rate by about 7 basis points. So the more we do the overlay, it brings it back up closer to the expected discount rate. We're already as low as we're going to get because it's purely all in cash right now.
We got time.
I think that's it.
What would be a motion to keep moving this forward without a 100% commitment?
Yeah, I don't think we need a motion.
Yeah,
I think we just direct staff to include it in the RFP and for SIS to bring back who they recommend to be, let's say, the top three in this field. Do a search, and then we can kind of get both sides of the equation. Because I'm not going to jump into this thing, my feeling, without seeing that and SIS's recommendation. And we don't need to take a vote to do that.
Okay. I think we should be. I think we all should be skeptical about this. It is a very...
You're older. Got it.
Can I ask one question? Is this something that's... Are you uncomfortable with? Okay. Well, I just want to know. I mean, this is a big step. It is a big step.
Yeah. I'm willing to consider it.
Okay.
Me too. I have an open mind about it.
I think that... What we may want to do, though, is if in a month or two, because we're going to be I'm actually going through the process of revising the investment policy, I'll need to get a decision at least whether I should change the investment policy.
I think if we need between now and then, when you're ready to revise the investment policy, is if we have a better idea of what potential costs might be associated with going in this direction. Then I think we'd be better able to be prepared to see a kind of a balance type.
It was like $33,000.
It was
five. A real small amount or at least $33,000.
Exactly. The minimum would be. And you know what? We would pay the minimum because the amount we'd be notionalizing would be very small.
Okay,
so it costs $35,000.
But the transaction costs, is what I'm saying.
They're very small. It's a bid ask spread with the exchange. It's DE.
This is a not necessarily sequential line of thought here, but. I'd really like to know the percent funded of the entire system of all these people.
Okay.
To find out if they're taking like a, like they're going to Vegas to try to make up some money because they're so bad off, or if some of these guys that are actually using it are really pure examples that we should be following.
Okay.
That's
pretty easy.
Vegas.
What's that?
Yeah. Well, they have, yeah, and they have none. They're not even thinking about it. Just like,
well, they just
put it out of the line.
17
Yeah. Okay. Most of the 37 acts use the Clifton Group to do it, is what I was told by them.
Yeah.
You told by Clifton?
No, I was told by the other CEOs.
Get my key.
That's good.
Just want to clarify, you know.
So, your time frame is how soon SIS can
So you're recommending alternative two.
What's that?
You're recommending alternative.
No, alternative one.
One.
So you want us to get SIS.
Put it in the RFP and then have SIS bring it back.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
That works.
Very good.
Okay. We have one brief item for closed session. So the latitude of the board, I'm going to take item 9 out of order because we have two members who will need to recuse themselves. So item 9, members forum. So Gordon?
Yes, according to our contracts with Medley and White Oak, we're allowed to see or ask for site agreements in some cases. If in those site agreements there are any additional rights, we're allowed to ask for them and get them. So based on that, I'd like to suggest that our administrator ask both Medley and White Oak to send any additional site agreements we're allowed to see for our education and give it to the board.
No, not Raven.
No. Raven has a problem.
Say it again.
We're allowed to see any other side agreements other parties have.
No, just the part about Raven. Say that yes.
Oh, Raven, the difference between Medley and White Oak is in White Oak and Medley, if we see a side agreement we want it, we can have it immediately, or we can wait and have it next year or whatever. We've got a lot of time.
Okay.
Raven has a clause that says, once you receive something, you have to make a decision within 30 days. I'm not aware enough about site agreements to be able to see something and make a decision right away. And if we receive it and we don't act, we lose our rights. So I'd like to wait on Raven.
Okay. I just wanted to know exactly what you were saying.
Yeah. It's just a slight language difference.
Okay.
Brad?
Nothing.
Joan?
Same.
Okay.
Yeah. I think if we're going to be contacting those two organizations anyhow, I don't think we've got an update lately from them, have we, on what their fund is doing?
Oh, yeah.
We've been getting
monthly reports, and it was included in SIS. Okay.
It's in Paul's thing every month.
It's in Paul's thing. We are.
I don't know. Okay.
Jim?
Is that conference in Phoenix been approved by the Chinese?
Yes.
Sometime I'd like to know what the dates are.
7th through the 9th. I just got it today.
Yeah, just sent out the agenda today.
What about the one in...
Check your BlackBerry.
What about the one in...
Of course,
that's gone. I know.
Your assistant has the agenda. It went out
I think
today.
It's 7th through the 9th.
Yeah, that's correct.
Anything else, Jim?
No, that's...
Okay. Mike?
What about the conference in October? Is it October or September? The Opal conference in Santa Barbara?
Opal. The other one that we were talking about, the exchange back and forth from you and I, we were just asking for clarification if you were wanting to. It's not been approved. It wasn't one of the ones that was, you know, that you guys take to the board annually. Not that it wasn't something that.
Well,
you know,
it's very similar. It's similar but different than the one in Arizona.
Right. So I just needed to know if you wanted to attend, you know, to bring it to the board to attend in place of Opal, you know, the one in January.
Yeah. Let me look at the agenda.
Or if you wanted to go to both.
I have to look at the agenda. I don't know. I don't want to go to both. Let me look at the agenda again. The one in Arizona seems to be more pensions board specific. but the one in Santa Barbara does have some pension stuff.
I attended one a couple of years ago, the Opal one in Santa Barbara. I was a little disappointed.
Oh, yeah.
It was really more directed towards the
investment side.
No, not investments, but what are the endowments?
No, we were just clarifying whether
Mike,
we want to be brought or not.
Do you want it to be brought before the board for approval?
We can look at it. We are the education committee.
Sure.
Okay.
That's the Oval Conference in Santa Barbara in, I think it's September 15, 16, 17.
So staff will research that, and the education committee will put it on the agenda for the board to approve or disapprove.
We got time for that?
Oh, yeah.
I stayed at the hotel where Kim Kardashian got ready before her wedding.
Nice.
For the audit.
That's good to know.
They're divorced now.
You know what?
Donna?
I actually attended the UC Berkeley Pension Education Seminar, and it, from what they told me, it's been completely reworked from previous sessions, and I would really, really endorse attendance at that seminar. It was very interesting. I started on Sunday, and the first day was spent talking about de-risking your portfolio and matching your cash stream. And it was very interesting. We worked through a lot of the math, and I got a lot out of it. I really thought that looking at the risk and the correlation and the math behind a lot of it was very interesting and was just chock full of information.
Do they always do that the last week in July?
It's usually right around there. Yes.
Yeah.
No.
Anything else, Donna?
No, that's all.
Maria?
Nothing for me.
Mr. Lynch?
No, sir.
Other than your, never mind. So, Don? Kelly?
It's not anything to bring to the board, but I probably should have done it in announcements. Those books are in. If anyone has interest in needing them, the ones that we ordered for the definitions and the Barron's books.
Very good book. Thank you.
Let me know if you guys need one.
Rick, any final thoughts? Nothing? Okay. We will now entertain a motion to move into closed session. Yes. I have a motion by Jeff Grover to move into closed session. Anybody else? Maria, you're going to? No. Maria?
Sorry. So I second that.
Yeah, okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 This is for me.
Oh, no.
Mike said you're not going to work.
Okay.